So this is, you know, this is a time of interesting beginnings, because I was noticing that the tree down the way has the first hint of yellow on its leaves. You know. And a few days ago I thought, wow, you know, I can feel fall is sort of like creeping around. In the background, we were coming down from Lake from Anthony Lakes, and it was hot. But, you know, I just had this, it's like, I feel it out there kind of weird thing happening. And then the university, everything starts up tomorrow. April puts on a happy face, yes.
Don't say anything like, I don't have to.
Yeah, many of us envy the retired among us. And for us, this is the beginning of a third year for this little community, which is actually astonishing to Kayla and myself, too. So, we're glad to have you here. And glad to have the opportunity to have you here, too. So thank you. For us, the summer had all kinds of interesting elements. And two of the high points of the summer were some teachings that we attended, which sort of kicked off our vacation, our actual vacation, with the Sakyi Trinzen, who is a lama in a line that goes back 1,000 years from uncle to nephew, 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 because they're monks, you know, usually, not always. Sometimes they get married, but that's a whole other story. This version happens to be married. His son was with him, which was interesting. But anyway, 1,000 years, and somebody that I have a connection with, and he had a big impact on me. And then, toward the end of the summer, we attended a retreat that Zatshoji did in outside of Yakima. And he always has a big impact on me in unexpected ways, because he doesn't really make a big deal out of anything. And then I kind of walk away and I think, I never heard that before. Or he really said something that made me see things in a really different way. And that happened at this retreat. And I thought, I think what I'd like to do is I'd like to share that with you all. What happened was that he took something which was a very basic kind of teaching, and something that I actually started with 2 years ago. And he shared it in a way which was totally new. I'd never heard it presented in this way. And I thought, I think I want to share that with everybody else. I think people will find that useful, and that would be a really nice way to start things out. So that's what I'll do. And it'll take a couple talks to work through that. But it also segues very nicely with the requests that were made in the spring, end of the spring and the summer, about what should I be talking about and what should we be practicing in the coming year. Because a number of people said we really like to spend more time learning about the practice of compassion and developing compassion. And so these things are actually connected, and I'll try and give you some idea of the connection tonight, I hope. If the evil eye wasn't watching, to reference something that we were talking about earlier, about saying, are you prepared? Yes, well, that invites the evil eye to, you know, in the Eastern, in the Eastern European Jewish tradition, you would never say, yes, I am prepared, because the evil eye for sure is listening. I never understood. My grandmother would say this, the evil eye is listening. I thought, listening? And you know, being a kid, for some incomprehensible reason, I never thought to ask, how does the evil eye listen? Yeah. But anyhow, that's what she used to say, the evil eye will be listening. All right. So, you know, I guess, I don't know, knocking on wood helps. Anyway, so we'll see how we can weave all of this stuff together. And if it doesn't quite work, you know, we are going to go there. I mean, that is my intention. Now, technically, when Tibetans talk about developing compassion and the practices that develop compassion, they talk about it as mind training. So you might not think mind training, isn't compassion heart training or something like that, but they say mind training. Of course, if you're Tibetan and you ask the question, where is your mind? They would point to the center of your chest. So, you know, there's perhaps more, you know, connection there, you might think. But anyhow, they do see it as a matter of mind training, very much in the way in which we would understand mind, sort of. Anyway, so we'll kind of do all of that, I hope. Well, we'll get there, certainly. If not tonight, we'll get there. And Kayla will do a meditation that's related to what I'm talking about. So we'll see how everything hangs together.
Especially since I lost my cheat sheet.
Well, you can go back upstairs during the break. So the place where I wanted to start, and the teaching that Choje gave us, was on the five aggregates, or the five skandhas is the Sanskrit word. And where this teaching comes from is it's very, very, it goes back to the beginnings of Buddhism. When you read the older scriptures and you have the Buddha, you have presumably recorded conversations the Buddha had with people. And we won't go into what presumably means right now, because that would take a long time, but let's assume that he did. He does talk about the five aggregates, or the five skandhas. And the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, was a very practical, pragmatic teacher. A lot of times people would ask him questions about where did the universe come from, or the equivalent of that, and he'd say, how's that going to help you to know the answer to that? I'm not going to talk to you about that. You know, it's like, what do you want to know? You're an unhappy person. Let's talk about that. You know, I got things to say that'll help you not be unhappy. And where the universe came from is not going to have any impact on your being happy or unhappy. And vain philosophical speculation is useless. So he was very practical. And one of the places that he very frequently started his teachings was to say, look, I'm not going to talk to you about anything that's metaphysical, and I'm not going to talk to you about anything that you're going to take on faith. You should never take anything on faith. Let's talk about your experience. Now, of course, I'm paraphrasing in modern language. He didn't say it that way at all. He had a much more elegant way of saying everything, of course. But basically what he said was, you know, let's start with your experience, and let's take a look at your experience, and just develop some common language, and let's be thoughtful about your experience. And so what do we know about your experience? What do you know about your experience? Well, for one thing, can we agree that you have a body? Most people would, yeah, I've got a body, no question about that. I mean, I suppose some people would refute that, especially philosophers, but basically speaking, yes, I have a body. He said, well, okay, so really what we're talking about here is all the material stuff that's around us, you know. We can agree that there is a category of experience of the material stuff that's around us. Yeah, okay. He said, all right, so that's one what we would call a category. He called them aggregates, which means piles, because he sat around with rocks, and he said, with small stones, and he said, okay, now, here we have this category of thing, or of experience, rather, what we would call phenomena. He said, how many things are in it? Can we count out all the things that are in that category? Like my body, your body, you know, the physical things, and he put stones down, so that's a pile or an aggregate. So there's all the things that are associated with the material world, and they identified all those things, like earth, water, air, all that kind of stuff, if you will. Okay. Now, what else? Now, everything in the world that you experience, you either like it or you don't like it or you're neutral about it. Is there any other possibility? Nobody could think of another possibility. I mean, that covers all the territory. You either like your experience and you want more of it. You don't like your experience, you want less of it. You don't want to get more of what you don't like. You do want to get more of what you do like, or you're totally bored, which is you're neutral about something. And, okay, yeah. So here's an aggregate with three stones: attraction, repulsion, neutrality. And everyone could agree that's something about experience. And every material thing that you experience, you have that relationship with. I said, okay. Now, the other thing is that everything you experience is like a thought or a perception. Isn't that true? Well, yeah, okay. I mean, all of our experience comes through sense organs. We see things, so that's one stone in the pile. We hear things, that's another stone in the pile. We smell things, we touch things. I'm missing something here. We taste things. Then he put a sixth stone down. Now, the sixth stone is what really confuses people, because we're all familiar with the five sense organs. But this is where things get a little bit more interesting. So we think things. Now, in the ancient world, in the Buddhist world, what the Buddha was saying was, when you have a thought and you are aware of that thought, you are perceiving that thought in the same way as you are perceiving a sight. Now, as a modern Americans, we tend to think that when we have thoughts, we think them, and that's somehow different than being just plain aware of them, because we have a different notion of will. Okay, so we could come back to talking about this at some point. It would be interesting to do, but I want to sort of set it aside at the moment. The main thing, though, is that for the Buddhists and for the Buddha, he said, you know, thought, in this sense, thought is just being aware of sort of an internal idea or sound, if you will. And in every case that you have one of those other perceptions, like seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, in addition to the fact you either want more of it or you want less of it, and it's usually in relationship to some material thing, in every one of those cases there's a thought or an idea that's associated with that perception. So now we have this third heap or skanda or category, which could be called perception or it could be called thought. And what was interesting about Zatsuji's teaching was he said, I'm going to call this category ideas, which I've never heard a Tibetan teacher do. The scholars call it perception, and I won't go into what the Sanskrit word is. It really doesn't make any difference. But he called it thought, or idea rather, not thought. He called it idea, and I thought that that was really interesting because it really gets at this other notion of things, which is we don't have what you might call bare perception of anything. We don't just see something and see it, because every time we see something, we have thoughts about it. Even if we don't know we have thoughts about it, we have thoughts about it. If I look at a rose, I can't look at a rose without having some idea about it that makes it be a flower, among other things, that makes it stand out from its environment in some way. The very fact that I perceive something as outside, as separate from the environment around it, from the Buddhist point of view, is the result of thinking. It might be subtle thinking or training. And the psycholinguists among us tell us that actually people divide up their perceptions of the world in different ways based upon what they believe and based upon their experience. I don't think this is apocryphal, but apparently there are people who live in certain jungles where there are, at least historically, where certain colors didn't exist. So when they were exposed to things that had those colors, they couldn't see them because those colors were not part of their experience. And similarly, skiers don't look at snow in the same way I look at snow. Not just because I look at snow and go, yuck, but because they look at snow and see textures of snow in relationship to their experience to it, which I don't even see. I mean, I could look at the same thing they're looking at and I wouldn't see that. So this is what's meant by thought or perception. So now we have these categories of the stuff, our reaction to the stuff in the sense of our feelings about it. We like it, we don't like it. Our perception, thought about it. So that's three things, he said. Now the fourth thing is typically called habits, but Zatsuji called it energy, which I thought was extremely interesting. And took me a while to figure out what the heck is he talking about. Because, you know, trained as a scholar meant I was too stupid to hear what he was saying because I kept hearing what I was hearing and thinking, and I had a hard time hearing what he was saying. So I actually had to ask him about this, and then he clarified it. And we had to go back to the Sanskrit. I was like, oh, is that what you're talking about? Oh, that's interesting. Why is he talking about it this way? Well, there is a part of us that is motivated by things that we don't fully understand, that moves in ways we don't fully understand. It has something to do with our will, has something to do with our emotions, has something to do with habits, has something to do with past history. All that stuff that, in a nutshell, is our personality and our personal history and our cultural history. It's in us, but we couldn't point to where it is. I mean, you know, psychologists look for it and biologists look for it, and they say, well, you know, you grow nerves when you have certain experience, mental ganglions, you grow ganglia when you have certain experience, or you know, they're looking for biochemical bases of memory and this, that, and the other thing. I don't think that they found where that stuff lives yet. Maybe they will or maybe they won't, I don't know. But anyhow, the Buddha pointed to that and he said, now here's this big category, and it's a lot of rocks in this category, because everything that we associate with will, memory, cultural conditioning, all that kind of stuff lives in there. Many of the things that generate certain ideas that we have about things are based in there. So now we got four categories, four skandhas, four piles. He said, now, does that cover everything? What's missing? Oh, yeah, I'm aware of all of that stuff. Right, moment by moment, I'm aware of things, I'm aware of my feelings, I'm aware of my thoughts, I'm aware sometimes of my habits or the kind of energy or emotional mood that I'm in, something like that. I'm aware of it. And awareness is different than all those other things, although it's mixed with them. You can't have perception without consciousness or awareness. But it's different. You know, consciousness and the perception of something are somehow different. And the Buddha recognized that and he articulated that. He said, so here are these five categories. He said, is there anything that's missing from that? And his students said, don't think so. That seems to cover everything. He said, so in those five categories, where do you find me, I, the person? And then his students would kind of break their heads on that one. And without all of us getting together and breaking our heads, what the Buddha said was, look, you can't really find a person apart from all those five things. You can't find a person in any one of those five things. You can't really exactly say that the person is all of those five things. And then he gave various analyses for why this is a problem. He said, for example, if the person was the body or totally depended on the body, then the person would be different if they lost a finger, but the person doesn't feel different subjectively when they lose a finger. And here's a much more interesting one. The body of a person who is, like myself, 65, I still feel like me, and actually I feel like the same me that I did when I was 20 years old. It still feels like me is the same me. It's like, how did I end up in this? You know, wait a minute. You know, yeah. It's like, what? You know? And I remember all the elderly people in my family who are like my age now or older. They'd say, how did this happen?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And you know, from my point of view as a kid, it was like, well, they were always that way. I mean, I couldn't imagine it then they were any other way. You know. Right, right. And then, you know, sometimes my father would tell me stories and I'd say, you did what? And I'd say, oh, okay, well, maybe you were different. But subjectively, I feel the same. But my body is totally not the same. So the Buddha would say, so obviously, your sense of I can't depend on the body. So he went through all these things in that way. Mostly, though, people will say, yeah, but you know what I think is that the I is really my consciousness. If there was anything that, you know, rock bottom was me, that I identified as being me, it'd be my consciousness. Because if I'm sound asleep and I'm not dreaming, I don't feel like I. The only time I feel like I is when I'm awake, which means I'm conscious. Right? So that's what most people would say. The Buddha, however, being, you know, the Buddha said, nah, he said, actually, I is just an idea. He said, I is an idea you have in relationship to all this experience that's going on. It's sort of like what we would call in modern language ego. You know, I mean, you develop ego over time, Right? You don't have it, according to modern thinking, you don't have it 2 days after you're born. Right? So it somehow develops, and that's a weird notion, that when I had a body without an eye, I don't mean eyeball, there was no eye, but I had a body, but how is that... From the Buddhist point of view, there's no sense going there. It doesn't make any sense. You get into these problems. He said, it's just a concept. But the way that concept works is that concept takes and labels all that concatenation, all that stuff that hangs together, and says, that's me, the person, personality. And he said, but the thing is, when you look for an actual person, so you have this idea, you have all these five aggregates, where is the person? So is the person in it? Is the person out of it? And it's like, so you, in this process, you develop a new sense of what it means to be a person, to be an I. So when we get into talking about developing compassion, right, one of the things that mind training is about in the development of compassion is you have to start out by understanding your own nature before you can start having compassion for other people, because you need to understand their nature before you can have compassion to them. So this is sort of a sidebar, right? If you go to the grocery store and the checkout lady is just being a complete pain and giving you a really hard time, you know, I mean, you might be feeling like, just, you know, cut it out. I'm the customer's always right, and so on and so forth, and I'm not going to put up with this. But if you asked the checkout lady what was going on, you might discover that, you know, she's a single mother, she's got two sick kids at home, and she can't afford the daycare, and, you know, she's not being irascible and difficult to you for any particular reason. Her life is hard. And she can't help but bring it to work. And when you see that sort of thing, then you can say, just stuff it, David, you know, and be patient, and, you know, you're not the center of the world. This lady has her issues, and we need to work all this stuff out. And you can develop a little patience for dealing with her difficult situation. But that means understanding her situation and understanding her and what created what was going on in that checkout situation. So mind training is about understanding yourself so that you can understand other people, so you can change the way you relate to them, which is the cultivation of compassion. Okay, so that was the sidebar. So back to what the Buddha was teaching, because that's where we're going in the future. So he said, so everything is in there, you know, and you can do various analyses on this, if you're curious, we can do, you know, in Q&A or some other time. But I don't want to get too far into that right now. But what Tsar-Choje said that was so interesting to me was something that 45 years plus of studying Buddhism had not occurred to me. It just goes to show how you can get fixated on things. Had not occurred to me. Buddha said, you can't find the person in the five aggregates, outside of the aggregates, or anything else. But what's going on when you're aware of the five aggregates in some? Because one of the aggregates that you're aware of is your own consciousness. So what Tsar-Choje said is, all of the stuff that makes up a person lives in existential space, if you will, which the Tibetans refer to as the sky-like mind, or the clear light. And it's sort of like, that's the place that you exist in that can be aware of the five skandhas, your personness, when you can get to the place of being outside of your personness, witnessing and fully understanding your personness. Because mostly we're so wrapped up in, I'm walking down the street and I'm looking at the first signs of fall, and on the one hand it's beautiful, but on the other hand, I'm going to be cold this winter and I never like that. And this is all this stuff that's going on.
Fetching.
It's like, fetching, right. It's like, you know, I'm not in that space like mind, you know, but if I go through this kind of whole process, then I kind of expand. And I can see my limited self. Now I say, I can see my limited self, but of course, it's not I that's seeing my limited self. This is the problem with English. You know, we have subject, we have predicate, we have, you know, so on and so forth, and we can't escape it. So we have to take this with a grain of salt, if you will. But it's sort of like, there is this place, if you will, bad word, because it's not a place, space-like or sky-like mind or awareness, which is our true nature. And that true nature, a clear light mind, that sky-like, space-like space, is actually also our Buddha nature. Because the Buddha was a person who got to that place, and he could go there anytime he wanted, and he could hang out there anytime he wanted. So when he went to the checkout line in the grocery store, and he ran into a lady who was having a hard time at home, you know, he didn't get bugged. He just sort of looked at her and thought, let me look at what's happening here. And his relationship to her was a relationship to a person having difficulties, because he wasn't hung up in his own little ego doing his thing, right? I mean, he saw it. It wasn't like it wasn't there. It's just he was bigger. He was in that place which is bigger and encompasses that. Now, it's very hard to talk about that place, because all the language that we would use to talk about that place is hanging out back down in one of those five skandhas someplace, right? So it's incomplete. It can't really embrace the whole. So metaphor is good for that. Poetry, image, so on and so forth. But what it does is it points to it. Sometimes the Buddhist scriptures refer to it as that. That's pretty good. That. Because what does that say? Second word. That. Sometimes it's Buddha nature, you know. But one thing that they did say is that the mind can't fully understand it. The mind will want it to either exist or not exist. Mm-mm, doesn't cover the territory. Okay. The mind will want it to be good or bad, permanent or impermanent. Doesn't cover the territory. Because there's no way for language to really get at that. Now, it doesn't mean that we can't experience that. We can experience that. We can experience our own Buddha nature. If we couldn't, there'd be no point in doing any of the stuff that Buddhists talk about doing and that we're trying to do. Okay. They also, Zatsuji also said something else that was really interesting. He said, all good qualities come out of that. That sky-like nature, that clear light mind. All good qualities naturally emerge from that. Why is that? It's because it's the truth. It's the truth of what I want to say is, but it's the truth of what's beyond is and is not. And all good things come out of it, because it encompasses everything and everyone, because it's in everything and in everyone and encompasses everything and everyone. Now, I hesitate to use words like G-O-D, but I think probably for a lot of people when they talk about Godhead, thinking about this in the most philosophical sense, they may be talking about the same thing. I'm not entirely sure. I suspect that that's true. That seems true to me. But this isn't a Sunday night on comparative religion. So I'll just sort of set that aside. That's my personal view. Okay. But, okay, all good things come out of that. And it is most easily comprehended by us in the form of the Buddha, who spent his life in that place, right? So the meditations that we do on images of the Buddha, various images of the Buddha, are actually meditations on that space or place as it begins to emerge in our understanding and in our perception and our sense of ourselves, right? As we feel our own Buddha nature, we feel ourselves as Buddhas in some form, male, female, whatever the case may be. It doesn't really make any difference. But that's when we have that sense of that. And so when we meditate on that, using that image, we're practicing reminding ourselves of getting into that spacious characteristic of our true nature, so we can see what's really going on within us. And also, not just so we can see what's really going on within us and train our minds to be more compassionate, more engaged, but also because when we're in that space, all good qualities naturally emerge from it and we grow and change. That to me was a very important teaching, because I'd always felt that there was a process of change going on in me through my own meditation practice. But my own meditation practice was just trying to get into that space. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I'm not doing any mind training. I mean, the Tibetans would say I'm a pretty lazy slug that I'm not doing this stuff. But my wife tells me I'm a much better person than I was 10 years ago. So something's going on. And so Rinpoche basically answered that. He said, in essence, we can practice on a practical level certain techniques within the space of our ordinary practical minds, day-to-day life, get up in the morning, have a cup of coffee, think about things, meditation practice. But we can also get into this deepest part of ourselves, and that has an impact too. And that the two work together. The two work together. So what we'll try and do, you know, this year, as sort of a theme, if you will, is see how we can work these two things together with very practical mind training exercises for developing compassion and better relationships with each other, and also meditation practices that will help us reach into that space which encompasses everything, including us, and is like going home, which, by the way, to sort of wrap things up, sometimes we talk about meditating on the Buddha, and you might see an image of the Buddha in some form sitting or standing on a lotus. But what you don't see is that the Buddha is always in what's called a mandala palace, which is to say his home. He's in a space that's physically bounded in a certain construction. They call it a palace because a Buddha wouldn't live in a hovel, of course. He'd live in a palace. Even if it was made out of twigs, it would still be a palace because he was in it. Wouldn't make any difference, you know. So this space, okay, that the Buddha lives in, or this palace, rather, this mandala that the Buddha lives in, is always implied, if not explicitly, at least implicitly, when you meditate on the Buddha. And this palace has a floor, four walls, and a ceiling. And there are four doors in it, and then there's a hole in the roof. There's a second story. Now, in ancient India, this was very practical because it was like air conditioning. All the heat went up through the hole in the roof and was blown away by the wind in the upper level. But everything in meditation is also metaphorical. And metaphorically, what the four walls and the ceiling represent are the five skandhas, which is form or material things to the front, feelings or our reactions to things to the right, thoughts or perceptions behind us, this energy or habit patterns to the left of us, and consciousness in the center or above us. But of course we're sitting on a lotus. And what is the whole thing? It's embraced in this space. Mm-hmm. It's embraced in this space. So these are the things that we'll be talking about in the next year, kind of foreshadowed or previewed this evening. Okay. You had a question, Mary.
I have two questions.
If I can answer the first one, then you can ask the second one.
And it's partly because it ends up in a dualistic form, but it's okay. If there's a... You're in this thatness, and you can have possible glimmers of it, and you experience this transpersonal space, this smaller ego self, momentarily maybe disappears, and you have a sense of your own Buddha nature. Now, at that moment, or at those times, since that is the reality, that's the truth, as you said, that's God, we can leave that if we want.
That's probably dangerous, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But is that also, you seem to be suggesting that is what unites us to everybody and everything.
Yes.
It would be that.
Yes.
Unity.
Yes, because everybody and everything lives in that space and exists in that space.
And all good things come from that. Mm-hmm. How, and we don't have to get into this now, but how does the Buddhist teaching account for the evil, the darkness, the mistakes? All good things come. Does it mean that evil's an illusion and it's actually all part of this huge...
No, it doesn't mean evil's an illusion.
I would think not. So at some point maybe we could...
Remember all those habit patterns and energy that I was talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. So Buddhists don't exactly talk about evil in that sense, but they do talk about all kinds of negative tendencies and patterns, which they sometimes personify as demonic energies. You know, that's a little problem for us, I think, because it raises all kinds of complicated issues. But that accumulated negativity is what will be called evil, if you will, or those negative energies. It's not so much that there's negativity. It's not that negativity emerges from that space, but negativity is in that space because of our behavior historically and that accumulated negative behavior. There's a... of course, Buddhists don't have creation stories because they don't believe in a god who created anything. But there is an interesting Buddhist story in one of the sutras about a time, a long time ago. And in this time, a long time ago, people didn't have material bodies. Okay, so it's going to sound a little bit like a Native American story. And I'm probably not going to get it quite right because I haven't read it for a long time, but I'll do my best. Okay, so there are all these beings without bodies who were living in this energy light world and so on and so forth, and everybody was perfectly satisfied with everything. But somebody had this idea that they might not get something that they needed. So instead of just taking what they needed, they took more than what they needed. Okay. And they sort of hoarded it aside. And then somebody else saw that somebody had taken more than they needed and hoarded it aside. And then they got to thinking, there must be a good reason for this. Maybe I better do the same thing. And pretty soon everybody was hoarding everything aside and sort of sneaking around grabbing the stuff from other people who were hoarding things aside. And that basically screwed everything up, because then there wasn't as much to go around as there had been. And then there were people who actually didn't get enough of what they needed, which made more people hoard things that they really didn't need to hoard because there was actually enough, but everyone was getting freaked out. And then when everybody got totally freaked out, then what happened? It was like the Hopi's talking about popping up into this world. It's like, okay, suddenly here we are. You know, and it's not like Buddha nature had changed at any time. It was always there, and it was always, everything was happening within that space. It's just people got to get thinking, I'm freaked out because there may not be enough to go around.
So it's delusion.
Definitely. Because there was enough. They didn't have to worry about it. Anyhow, that's the story. Now, it's a story. It's an instructional story. It's not like, you know, on the seventh day God rested in, you know, the kind of conservative Christian tradition that, like, this literally happened. This is a story. It didn't literally happen.
But
I don't think.
It's not much different than Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden.
Except
that it sets time in motion, and there we are.
Right.
We're in our bodies.
Right.
We're in generations. So.
But it's only a story because Buddhists are very cautious about first causes. Because in the Buddhist sense, like, if you start looking for first causes, like, you know, how did this get created? Then you have, from their point of view, definite problems, as in that there has to be a creator, a time before things were created. And they see that stuff as illogical. So they just say, well, those are all totally unknowable. And that makes people really unhappy.
He says that we are composed of stories.
Who's this?
Barry Lopez. He says we are composed of stories. Stories and compassion. And so stories are really, really, really
stories are very important. But it's important to know the difference between a story and a literal, you know, hardcore material thing happening. You know, stories are about more than just matter. And they're not limited by just literalness. You have to
and
bring
recognizing
out
one's storyline. And the perception,
right, and
the
getting
all of that.
Stories. Yeah.
Right, and then the storyline has to do with that skanda of energies and thoughts and what have you.
Well, we kind of continue with that story on Earth, don't we?
I'm afraid we do.
Some people have to have a lot, and other people have to go without.
With that story,
Some people have the story of. Some people have the story of my diamond ring better be bigger than my neighbor's. or else I'm not any good.
Yeah. The story starts with the people that told you stories first.
Well, yeah, and one of the things that one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot lately is I've been noticing my subtle reactions to things. Mm-hmm. And my likes, dislikes, back to that skanda. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, can I remember the earliest time I had that reaction? Mm-hmm. And what was going on? And usually what was going on was I was hanging out with my parents. And I thought that was my feeling. Mm-hmm. But, you know, on reflection, I'm not so sure that that was my feeling. Right. But I thought it was my feeling, and then it became my feeling, and then I believed that thing,
right.
You know? And, well, wait a minute. No, that was what my mother's feeling was, but I got that confused. Mm-hmm. So I've been working with it a lot lately.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. Very beneficial.
So then that creates some interesting questions about who the heck am I? What's going on? But it's all part of this mix. It is. It's all part of this mix.
And be still.
And it also... Well, it does. It does. And it's also an interesting opportunity for practicing compassion toward myself. Mm-hmm. Because now I'm looking at, oh, I just spent the last 60 years feeling this way when I didn't even feel that way at all in the first place, but I believed it, and so then I did, and oh, what a waste of time.
That's the best.
Uh-huh. Well, when you get into that, then you can sort of like, okay, you wasted your time, but... Hey, you know, the Japanese have this very nice way of talking. In the Japanese Pure Land Buddhist tradition, they have this very nice way of talking about the human condition, and they say, "We're all foolish humans, so what do you expect?" Yeah. Okay. More questions, and then we take a break and do a meditation. Yeah, Brian.
What Mary said. And what you were talking about reminded me of, I've been doing a lot of driving this week, out in the hinterlands where public radio fades away and it's down to country western and Jesus and conservative politicians. And, you know, I found myself listening to things, and the point where I just had to punch the button was when the judgmental thing came in.
Yeah.
It's like, well, that's very interesting. And I was thinking of when, like with the three piles of stones, mm-hmm. you can say, okay, I like what this person's saying. And then you go, oh, I don't like what they're saying. But when you get to the point of like, I was listening to this show and it was a call-in show, and this woman called in and said she was going to a Christian study group and they were meditating on Jesus. And like they were like basically breathing, and but then thinking about Jesus when they were meditating. And she asked the preacher if this was okay, and he said, "No way, Jose. That's very." And I learned a new term, non-scriptural, very non-scriptural. And I was like, "Oh, this is really interesting." So that's kind of the judgment thing. It's like it's not just like, "Well, I don't like this." It's like, "No, this is bad. This is evil, if you will." And I was thinking, you know, when you're... Number one, I just don't find that very useful in my own life, but I also thought, boy, this creates a lot of problems. And I was kind of curious in the... You know, in that idea of, like, I like this, or, you know, I find this attractive or pleasurable. No, this is annoying, or I don't like this. Which is okay. So it's the difference between, like, you know, well, I like chocolate, but I don't like strawberry, you know, but that's okay. I'm not going to go to war over this. But it's like, you like chocolate, you're bad. I'm going to kill you, kind of thing, you know. That, you know, on a certain level, we all have to make those judgments, you know, on because it's like, you know, if it's like, well, I don't like chocolate, but, oh, chocolate is poisonous, it'll kill me. You know, if you're going to stay alive, you need to figure that out and make that judgment, I guess. But I don't really know what my question is, but I guess it's, you know, it really triggered that it'll link those together when you talk about how you perceive different things in the world that you come across, and that tolerance thing versus the judgment thing. You know, it's a line we all kind of have to sort out.
So if I could guess at what the question might have been that was behind the question that you didn't ask, I think you, in a sense, you actually answered it, though, with the word tolerance, which is kind of an interesting word. Now, when we say tolerance, it doesn't necessarily have really positive connotations for us. It's like, I'm going to tolerate this thing. It's like pretty judgmental. Like, you know, it's like, it's not a very good thing, but I'm going to put up with it. But it gets at something, which is the teaching about the five skandhas informs us that as long as we're human beings, all these things are going to be going on. And we're not going to get away from this happening. But we can have a different relationship to our experience of it happening. So I have a real problem with country music. I have a very big problem with country music. Right? So in the realm of, you know, in the realm of feelings, I have, it's like very hard for me to shop at Safeway because of this, you know. Okay. So we know where this is. But irrespective of the fact that I'm never going to escape country music at Safeway, irrespective of that, I'm also never going to escape the fact that I have aversive reactions. Now, I could stop having an aversive reaction to country music, and that probably wouldn't be all that hard to do, you know. I mean, if I studied music, I would probably find that there are many wonderful things in country music that I hadn't noticed. And there was a time when jazz left me neutral, and now I have a very attractive reaction to it. So in that kind of music, it went from neutral to attractive. And I'm sure that my sense, you know, but that's not even the point. The point is that if I got over being unhappy about having to listen to country music, there would be something else that I would not like. It would just take its place, you know. And I don't know what it would be. I'm sure there would be something. That is the human situation. So, but what we can do from the Buddhist point of view, what we can do is get into the space where that's happening, but it's not troubling. Mm-hmm. Zachoje Rinpoche also has this very interesting teaching. He says, you know, he doesn't like to talk about suffering. I mean, that's sort of the standard Buddhist language for, you know, a world of suffering. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't go well with Americans anyway. And it may not be the best possible translation of the original term. Mm-hmm. He says, struggle. He says, existence is struggle. He said, but a lot of people struggle with the notion that they have to struggle. So they got more struggling going on. He said, there's just struggle out there, so don't worry about it, just struggle. But don't struggle against struggling, because that just makes it harder.
You don't have to qualify it, quantify it.
And that's, it's sort of like, you know, when you can get into this space where it's kind of like, boy, there's David in Safeway making himself miserable because he doesn't like country music, and that's totally unnecessary. But there it is. Okay, now where are the olives? You know, and we'll go on to the next thing. And like, yep, it's still going on, David. Yeah, all right. And where's the ketchup? You know, this kind of thing. So
I hum when I'm in Safeway.
You hum?
Yeah, I don't like music either. So I think of a song when I get out of my car. And I go in there and I hum it the whole time.
I'm totally unaware.
Yeah, your question.
So, what does Skylight of the Mind sound like into them?
It's sky-like.
Oh, sky-like. Okay.
Sky-like mind, and. You know, I don't actually know what the Tibetan is for the sky-like mind, but I'll look it up and I'll tell you.
It is sky-like. Thank you for clarifying that. And does sky-like of the mind have colors?
It has everything.
It has everything.
I mean, everything is in
everything,
it.
Everything that it could ever
When the scriptures say what it is, mm-hmm. I mean, mostly they don't want to do that. They just mm-hmm. say that. But every once in a while you find the Buddhist scriptures will say something about that. Mm-hmm. And the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, which are sort of the if you will, the final word. There is no such thing as final word, but they're like the big authoritative, most holy thing going in Mahayana Buddhism, except for all the other things that are more authoritative and more holy. But on the whole, the big holy thing, because in Buddhism it's, you know, whatever, you know. Because there's no central authority that says this is okay and that's not, right? So if somebody gets enlightened sitting on a mountain someplace and they said, no, the big thing is this, not that, everyone says, oh, yeah, it must be this, not that. But then another guy gets enlightened or another chick gets enlightened. It's like, no, no, it's that other thing. Not, it doesn't, you know, that's Buddhism. Anyway, where was I with this? Oh, yeah. When they talk about that, they say it's clear and knowing. Mm-hmm. Now,
luminous.
They sometimes say luminous and knowing, sometimes say clear and knowing. Alex Berzin, who is really a great scholar, and by the way, if you ever want resources online, the Berzin archives are as good as it gets. Alex, B-E-R-Z-I-N. Okay. Alex, it was a late or middle 60s PhD at Harvard in Buddhist studies or something like that. And he promptly went to Dharamsala and he just didn't leave until he got kind of old. And then his German students took him in and now they have this big project going on. There's someplace in Germany. So the Berzin archives are an unbelievable resource of quality, authoritative things. Alex has his own way of translating everything. Often I don't agree with his translations, but he's totally brilliant. And I will defer to most of what he has to say. He did a long thing on what clear or luminous refers to. And, you know, we think of clear as clear versus obscure. And he said, no, that's not what it's about. So the clear-like mind is not like it's clear versus the obscure mind. It means clear as in the clarity of presence, which is a whole other kind of thing. So like luminous as in the natural luminosity of existence would be the same thing. And knowing is very interesting because it doesn't mean knowing in the way in which we would say, I know that the university is over in that direction. It's more, knowing is more in the sense of like the capacity to cognize in my language. It's like the ground ability to be knowledgeably aware or something like that. Again, you know, the language is going to fail.
Yeah.
So clear and knowing is going to be a problem. But it's important to know that even though we can say it's beyond is and is not, and that all the words that we have for referencing what clear means and what knowing means, it's important to know that every one of us can experience this because it's what we actually are. And when we experience it, then you don't have to ask the question, what does that mean? Because by experiencing it, you know what it means. And that solves the problem, because I can't, right. It solves the problem of David's incapacity to explain it to you. Because when you get there, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, right. Except it's not even that, but you get the point.
And you can, there are traditions like within the Kagyu, I think it's the Kagyu tradition, where they actually, the Kagyu tradition, where they actually use the sky, you know, literally sky, as an object of meditation. To work with that kind of unimpeded spaciousness and to try and, you know, get some kind of feeling for it.
It's because it's such a powerful metaphor.
Beyond vast.
When we were in our vacation took us to Stanley, Idaho, and we were in this really nice place where we had this extensive view over cattle grazing lands to then the flanks of the Sawtooth Mountains with like the forest coming up them to this, you know, then almost the entire expanse of the Sawtooth, so just like this unbelievable spaciousness. and you're at 6,500 feet, so that helps elevate you in many ways. And there are not a lot of people around, which is really helpful too. You know, and it's like everything is kind of loggy, kind of cabin houses, and it's like all down to earth and basic, and people fried by the sun and the clean air. And you're up where the Salmon River begins, also at the headwaters of the Salmon. So this is kind of a remarkable place, and it has this sense of like. So we were really into like, oh yeah, the skyline. Like, it's a natural metaphor. You could see how the Tibetans would adopt it in their environment, which is even more so.
Yeah.
You know, because there's something about getting into that kind of spaciousness that has this impact, this physical impact,
why
at least on
Zen
us.
Use emptiness so much then?
Can we save that for another time?
Yes, we can.
Okay, Zachuji actually referenced this in a conversation with me. He said when the Zen teachers talk about no mind, which is often the way emptiness gets translated through the Zen teaching, they're talking about that spacious mind.
Yeah.
They don't mean that there's no mind. Mm-hmm. What they mean is the big mind, or the mind which is not the little mind. Therefore, it's no mind by the definition of what we think mind is. It's not that. Unimpeded. Unimpeded is good.
Yeah, unimpeded.
Yeah, unimpeded is a good one.
Yeah, it is.
Because...
with the translation, with the verbiage.
Because there are no limitations of time, space, thought. Everything that creates limitations is the product of our own thinking. And there's nothing wrong with thinking. I'm not knocking thinking. It's a very valuable skill. Some of us make a living by thinking. And we know what happens when we're around people who don't know how to think. We know that's a problem. That's a problem. So I'm not knocking thinking. But thinking does not get us in. Thinking can move us in this direction, but it will not allow us to fully embrace what is, because thinking can't do that. Because thinking is based upon this, but not that. Alternatives.
Yeah. And one other thing is, you know, we've talked a little bit. You guys won't have heard of this maybe, but of the Dakini, which is like this female energy. What is this? Well, it said that the Dakini is also called a sky dancer.
Oh.
And that's what it means. Oh. It means somebody who can be in this space and dance.
And move through it freely.
Yeah, move through it freely. Yeah. So it's really, and also,
that's a great image.
The wisdom that comes with that is also called, like, the name of that book, which is Warm Breath of the Dakini. So it's kind of like the whispering of that energy or that spaciousness, you know, kind of coming through. Mm-hmm. So there's, so it is, it's a wonderful, hopefully maybe in the meditation we'll get there. We'll try to get there.
We're going to try and